Welcome to the Depth Dive. Today we're getting into something called random geometric graphs, or RGGs for short.
Right. It's basically a framework, a way of thinking about how connections form just because things are near each other, spatially.
Exactly. And we're diving into this using Matthew Penrose's big book on the topic as our, well, our guide.
It's a great source. So RGGs.
Yeah.
You start with points scattered in space. Maybe randomly.
Okay.
And then you just draw a line, an edge, between any two points if they're closer than some specific distance. That's the core idea. Simple, but powerful.
Like connect the dots, but only the close dots. You can picture it, right? A scattering of points and lines only pop up between nearby neighbors. Okay, so why dive into this? What's the hook for, you know, for you listening?
Well, what's really fascinating is how versatile these are. They sound maybe a bit abstract, but they pop up everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Like where?
Well, statisticians use them a lot, actually, to see if patterns in spatial data are just random chance or something more interesting, like clustering.
Ah, okay. Testing hypotheses about points on a map, maybe?
Exactly. Computer scientists find them useful, too, for things like figuring out how to lay out components on a chip or how to partition large data sets efficiently.
Right. Physical layout problems.
And then there are the models of real-world networks, things like finite element graphs in engineering, integrated circuits, communication networks.
Wow. Okay. That's broad.
It is. And some researchers are even exploring if RGG ideas can help model connections in the brain cortex. It's really about proximity driving connection.
Brain connectivity, just based on neurons being close. That's pretty wild. So our mission today, then, is to pull out the key insights from Penrose's work. Understand what these random structures do and why they matter, wherever you're coming from.
Sounds good. Where should we start? Maybe the stat side.
Yeah, let's do that. You mentioned statisticians use them for testing things. How does that work?
Right, the statistical motivation. So imagine you've got your data points, maybe locations of trees in a forest or disease cases in a city. You build an RGG on these points.
Okay, connect the nearby ones.
Yep. And then you look at the properties of the graph you just built. Those properties become your test statistics.
What kind of properties?
Well, the simplest is just counting the edges. How many connections did you get? Is it more or less than you'd expect if the points were just scattered randomly?
Makes sense. More connections might mean clustering.
Exactly. Or you can count more complex things like cliques. These are groups where every point is connected to every other point in the group, like a little tight-knit huddle.
Triangles, squares, that sort of thing.
Triangles, squares, where all points are linked, yeah. And the size of the biggest clique you find that's called the scan statistic. It's like looking for the densest hotspot in your data.
Ah, so finding a surprisingly big clique could point to a significant cluster.
Precisely. And you can go beyond just counting connections. You can look at the distances themselves. Like, what's the distribution of distances from each point to its absolute nearest neighbor?
Or maybe not just the nearest, but the second or third nearest.
Yes, exactly. The kth nearest neighbor distances. The pattern there tells you a lot. Even just finding this single largest nearest neighbor distance in the whole data set can be informative.
Huh. And you mentioned using RGGs to check for unimodality, like if a cluster has one peak or many?
That's right. Particularly with techniques like single linkage clustering, where you sort of grow connections based on closeness, the RGG structure that emerges can help you figure out if your clustered data seems to stem from one main underlying process or several.
Okay.
And there's this idea of the connectivity threshold. That's the distance you need before suddenly pretty much all the points become part of one single connected network.
The point where it all links up.
Yeah. And that threshold itself can be used to spot outliers, points that stay stubbornly disconnected even when the connection distance is pretty large. Might be unusual, right? They might be outliers.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so RGGs give statisticians a toolkit for spatial data. Let's shift gears a bit. What's the mathematical machinery behind all this?
Okay, the foundations. It's built on probability theory, fundamentally. You usually start with a set of M points. Let's call it Xn.
Or random points in space.
Right. Randomly placed in some d-dimensional space. And typically, we assume they're independent where one point lands doesn't affect the others, and they all follow the same underlying probability rule. We often describe that rule with a density function, f.
F just tells us the likelihood of finding a point in any particular spot.
Pretty much, yeah. It governs the distribution. Now, if that function f isn't just uniform, if it varies, things can get a bit more technical. That's where the idea of a Lebesgue point comes in.
Lebesgue point. Sounds technical.
It is a bit, but the intuition is kind of simple. It basically says that for most nice density functions, if you zoom in really, really close to a specific spot, the average density of points in your tiny zoom window will match the actual density f specifies right at that spot. It ensures the density function behaves predictably at a very local level.
Okay, so it's about the density making sense even when you zoom right in. Got it. And there was a specific function you mentioned earlier, hx.
Yes, hx. It's defined as x times log x minus x plus 1, with h0 set to 1. This function just shows up a lot in the probability calculations for RGGs.
Why is it important?
Well, one key thing is that its minimum value is 0, which happens when x equals 1. And it appears in formulas that give us bounds on probabilities, ways to limit how likely certain outcomes are. You see it in some of the key lemmas like 1.1 and 1.4 in Penrose's book. It's a useful mathematical tool.
A tool for bounding probabilities. And what about Poissonization? You mentioned that too.
Right, Poissonization. This is a really clever mathematical trick used throughout the field.
A trick? Okay, I'm intrigued.
So often we're dealing with a fixed number of points, n. Poissonization means we relate this scenario to a slightly different one, where the total number of points isn't fixed, but is itself random, following a Poisson distribution with some average rate.
Why do that? Isn't that more complicated?
Actually, it often makes the math simpler. The randomness in the number of points smooths things out, makes calculations easier. Then, once you get results for this Poissonized version, you can often translate them back to understand the original case with the fixed n. It's a powerful technique.
Huh. Use a different, slightly randomized setup to understand the fixed one better. Neat. Okay, so we have the points, the connections. What about the patterns within the graph, subgraphs, and components?
Exactly. We often want to know how many times a specific small pattern, a particular subgraph, let's call it ORF, appears inside our big RGG.
Like, how many triangles are there, or how many paths of length 3?
Precisely. JN is the notation for the number of subgraphs that look exactly like ORF in our RGG with endpoints.
Yeah.
And JN is the same count, but in the Poissonized version.
So we're literally counting these shapes.
We are. And to understand the behavior of these counts, especially how they change as we vary the number of points n or the connection radius horn, we often calculate moments.
Moments, like average variance.
Yeah, exactly. Average variance, skewness, kurtosis, often up to the fourth moment. These moments tell us not just the typical number of subgraphs, j, we expect to see, but also how much that number tends to fluctuate around the average. This is particularly insightful when we focus on a specific region, a bounded set A, and see how counts behave there.
Okay, so moments give us the average count and the spread around that average. Makes sense. What about individual points? How connected is a typical point?
Good question. That leads us to vertex degrees. The degree of a vertex, or a point, is just the number of connections it has. We use γk, n, to mean the number of points that have exactly k connections in an RGG with n points total.
And w prime k lambda for the Poisson version.
Quiescent, yep. We're often interested in the overall distribution of these degrees. Like, if you pick a point at random, what's the probability it has, say, 5 connections?
And what does that distribution look like? Is it predictable?
Often, yes. Under certain conditions, especially when the expected number of neighbors is not too large, the distribution of degrees can be very well approximated by a Poisson distribution. Theorem 4.1 in the book lays out the conditions for this.
So the number of neighbors a point gets is sometimes like a random Poisson process happening around it.
That's a great way to think about it, yeah. The exact conditions depend on how the expected number of neighbors AN behaves as N grows and relate to the volume of the connection region around a point, that ball BNXT.
Okay, so we understand typical connectivity. What about the extremes? The points with the most connections or the biggest interconnected groups.
Right. Moving to the extremes. First, there's the maximum degree, usually written as n. That's just the highest degree any single point has in the entire graph. The biggest hub, basically. Exactly. And how ERN behaves as the graph gets bigger and increases depends crucially on how the connection radius ERN changes relative to n. There are different regimes. If the expected number of neighbors per point ERN stays small or constant or grows large, the maximum degree behaves differently. Corollaries in theorems like 6.6 and 6.7 detail this.
So more points and a bigger connection radius likely lead to some points having lots of connections.
Generally, yes. Then there are the cliques, those fully connected groups we mentioned. Finding the size of the largest clique, the clique number, is a classic hard problem.
How big can they get in an RGG?
We can get bounds estimates based on how densely we can pack spheres or balls in higher dimensions into the space. It relates to something called the packing density.
Yeah.
If you can pack spheres very efficiently, you might intuitively expect to be able to form larger cliques.
Well, like fitting more points close enough to all connect.
Kind of, yeah. There's a famous result by Thu for the best way to pack circles in 2D, for instance.
Okay. And there's a relationship between cliques and other graph properties.
Yes. Equation 6.62 highlights a nice one. The clique number is related to the stability number, the size of the largest group of points where none are connected, and the chromatic number, the minimum colors needed, so no connected points share a color. They're all intertwined aspects of the graph structure.
Fascinating how these local rules lead to complex global features. Mm. Okay, let's talk about when the graph stops being lots of little pieces and becomes one big connected thing. Percolation, right?
Exactly, percolation. This is a huge topic. In RGGs, it's about the emergence of a giant component. As you increase the connection radius, N, or density of points, you reach a point where suddenly a single connected component contains a substantial fraction of all the points.
A phase transition, almost.
Very much like a phase transition. There are critical thresholds, critical probabilities, PCCC, or critical densities, that mark this transition. Below the threshold, you have lots of small, isolated clusters. Above it, bam, the giant component appears.
Like flipping a switch.
Kind of, yeah. It could be quite sharp. We studied the size of the largest component, L1G. And maybe the second largest, L2G. There are results, especially for RGGs, on regular lattices about how these sizes behave, particularly when the connection probability P is high.
And you can estimate the probability of unusual sizes.
Yeah, that's where large deviation results come in, like Lemma 9.01. They tell you how unlikely it is for the largest component to be significantly larger or smaller than its typical size.
What about connections stretching out infinitely? Does that happen?
That's a core concept in infinite RGGs or percolation on infinite lattices, you can ask. Mm-hmm. What's the probability that the component connected to the origin just keeps going forever? There's often exponential decay associated with certain connection probabilities captured by a function.
So the chance of being connected to infinity drops off fast sometimes.
Right. And relatedly, on a lattice, you can think about the probability of being able to disconnect the origin from infinity by removing points or breaking connections within a finite region. Theorem 10.18 is important here. It tells us that above the critical threshold in continuum percolation, not only do you have a giant component, L1, but the second largest component, L2, is significantly smaller.
So one dominant network clearly emerges.
Yes, that's a key feature. It really separates itself.
This sounds incredibly relevant for understanding things like network resilience or how information spreads. Okay, let's shift focus again. Layout problems. What's that about? Designing circuits.
Yeah, the motivation often comes from things like VLSI design.
Yeah.
Very large scale integration. You have this complex network, maybe modeled as an RGG, and you need to physically arrange its components, maybe on a line or a grid. The goal is to do it efficiently.
Efficiently how? Yeah. Minimizing wire length.
That's one way. That's the minimum linear arrangement problem, or MLA. You arrange the points, vertices, on a line, and you want to minimize the sum of the lengths of all the edges connections. The cost is LA for a given layout.
Okay, what else?
There's minimum bandwidth, MBW. Mm-hmm. Here you still arrange points on a line, but you want to minimize the maximum stretch of any single edge. Keep connected points as close as possible in the linear order. Cost is BW.
So avoiding really long connections in the layout.
Exactly. Then there's minimum bisection, MBIS. You want to cut the graph into two equal halves with the minimum number of edges crossing the cut. Cost BIS, useful for partitioning.
Right.
And related ideas like minimum cut, MCUT, minimum sum cut, MSC, minimum vertex separation, MVS. Each has a slightly different cost function, measuring some aspect of how good the layout or partitioning is, often related to communication costs or physical constraints.
So lots of ways to define an optimal arrangement, depending on what you care about. Total wire, congestion, clean cuts.
Precisely. And a lot of research looks at how the best possible costs for these problems behave in certain limits, like when you have a huge number of points, the thermodynamic limit,
yeah,
or when the graph is very densely connected. Lemmas 12.19 and 12.21 give some results on these optimal costs.
Understanding the fundamental limits of how well you can arrange these networks. Cool. Okay, one last major area. Connectivity thresholds. We touched on this, but let's revisit when the whole graph becomes connected.
Right. Chapter 13 delves deeper. We often want more than just basic connectivity. We want resilience. So we look at the Canon plus one connectivity threshold. This is the connection distance R needed to ensure that the graph remains connected, even if you remove any Canon points.
Ah, so it measures robustness against failures or removals.
Exactly. How much buffer do you have? There are strong laws, like laws of large numbers, for this threshold, especially when the points are in a bounded space like a unit cube.
Does it simplify in one dimension?
It does. For points on a line, D equals one, the connectivity threshold is related to something called K spacings, which essentially measure the largest gaps between points. So the largest gap determines when everything gets linked up.
Interesting link there. What about other point distributions, not just uniform in a box?
The book also touches on the threshold. When points follow a multivariate normal distribution like a bell curve in higher dimensions, the principles are similar, but the math changes.
Okay. And what about the number of separate pieces?
Right, we can track Kx, the number of connected components. As you increase the connection radius towards the threshold where everything connects, this number Kx tends to stabilize. And interestingly, right around that critical connectivity threshold, the distribution of the number of components that are left often approaches a Poisson distribution.
So the way it breaks into pieces near the connection point follows a predictable random pattern.
Often, yes. It tells you about the fragmentation and coalescence process near that critical point.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot to cover. From basic statistical tests using simple connections all the way to phase transitions, percolation, optimal layouts, and robust connectivity. It's clear these random geometric graphs are, well, a really rich and powerful framework.
They really are. It's amazing how that simple rule connect if close generates such complex and interesting behavior across so many different scales and applications.
And as you said, this deep dive, it really just gives a taste of what's in Penrose's work and the field more broadly. There's so much more depth there.
Absolutely. Tons of ongoing research, open problems, things like precisely how components grow near that critical percolation threshold, getting tighter bounds on things. Lots to explore.
So maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. How could these ideas, connections driven by proximity, sharp thresholds where global behavior changes, the structure of random networks, how could they help us think differently about things in our world? Maybe the spread of information online, or the resilience of power grids, or even how biological ecosystems function.
Yeah, those are exactly the kinds of questions where RGG principles might offer some real insight.
Definitely something to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into random geometric graphs. Until next time, keep thinking about those connections.